Welcome to Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. We have got a tasty lineup of topics today, starting with the truffles, toffees, and turtles of the best chocolate in town. We'll talk with owner Elizabeth Garber about what it's like at her Mass Ave chocolate shop right now, and we'll also hear about building the business and the challenges that entailed. We'll also get a peek into the candy kitchen of Carrie Abbott of Newfangled Confections and find out about Frittle, one of her signature products, as well as some of the other treats she's cooked up. And this week we kick off the EatDrinkIndy.com and WFYI Holiday Cookie Contest. We'll hear about last year's winner, which was a lovely tangerine shortbread cookie submitted by local baker Lori Goldsby. And we'll get some cookie making advice from some of last year's judges, Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College, Nicole Ann Key Anderson of Four Birds Bakery, and A. Renee Trevino of Renee's Bakery in Broad Ripple. And to put all of this holiday cooking and baking in perspective, we'll hear from newspaper editor Donna Kronk of the Newcastle Courier-Times about how recipe contests and home cooks have changed over the years. It's a great show today, so stay with us for more here on WFYI and WFYI.org. As home cooks everywhere are gearing up for Thanksgiving, or maybe finishing off the last stash of the leftover Halloween candy, some of us are already in the midst of the holiday crunch. And if your business is called the best chocolate in town, well, that holiday crunch is going to last all the way through Valentine's Day. To find out what life in a chocolate shop is like right now, I caught up with Elizabeth Garber, owner of the best chocolate in town, which makes truffles, turtles, toffees, dipped pretzels, and all sorts of treats on Mass Ave in downtown Indianapolis.
This time of year is extra crazy. There's a lot of coffee in the shop to keep us going. And a lot of sweets, even besides our usual sweets we make. It's a lot of fun, but it's a lot of making chocolate and a lot of folding boxes. So it's a good time.
Now, when does the busy season start? Has it already started?
Yeah, it's already started. Kind of early, we start about January 5th, I start thinking about the next year. But really, in July, we have little meetings like, hey, what should we do differently this year? Things like that. But it really starts to, corporate starts contacting us, and we start trying to nudge corporate, like, do you want to be in the list this year? Starting in October, to try to get our ducks in a row and think about the amount of product we're going to have to buy in for packaging, because we have to call our vendors. So we really try to plan it. It's just a big increase in product. So it's just a real big logistical, I hate to use the word nightmare, but logistical
challenge,
adventure.
Right? Adventure. So it's about more than chocolate and pretzels and dipping, that sort of thing. So tell me a little bit about what goes on here at the best chocolate in town on a typical day building up to the holidays.
A typical day, people come in and we get kind of settled in, get some good music on, drink some coffee, turn the machines on, kind of designate who's doing what needs to get done, what orders are up, that need to be worked on or packed, and look a little long-term out, like what, you know, different processes take several days. And so looking a little farther out, what needs to start now so that we have it in a few days. Kind of just that, and we start at it, we go at it, so.
Now, the shop is full of truffles and chocolates and caramels. There's a lot of product here. The idea of just, you know, having all of that stuff here all the time, it seems incredibly daunting. How did the business build up so that you have a shop full of chocolate all the time?
One truffle at a time. I guess some of it just, just depending on where we wanted to be. We've talked before about growing and starting from my mother's dining room table at Christmas time in 98. And before that is a little holiday, I'll make chocolate, for, like my own mini bake sale, and for extra spending money. And then officially as a real business in 98, and I wrote a business plan. And then over time, I've just kind of slowly built up clients and started out wholesale and built up some clients and gift basket companies and who would use us at the time and did all my own sales and made the product and brought people in to help make product and just slowly, yeah, truffle by truffle, kind of built it up and here we are today. So
now, how many kinds of truffles do you have?
We have about 40 truffle flavors. We have some seasonal flavors. And for the holidays, we've got our eggnog, gingerbread, candy cane. We have a spice cake, a dried cherry, pistachio. I feel like I'm leaving something out.
And these are in addition to all the other yes. truffle flavors, which aren't your typical truffle flavors.
Right. We definitely, yeah, we have our mainstays that people love. And everything from your chocolate raspberry truffle to dark and stormy with ground ginger and rum. That's a new one.
Oh, that one sounds wonderful.
And gorgonzola, that's a famous one that people are like, where's, do you have the gorg still? Yes, we have it. So we like to, you know, we keep certain ones because people love them. And then we trade out some limited edition seasonal kinds of things depending on the time of year.
Are there some that you just can't get rid of?
Yes. The honey lavender.
Really? Now that wouldn't yes. have been my guess.
We have, so that, you know, over the years, the longer you're in business, you see these flavor trends, right? And God bless sea salt, right? So, but there was a time lavender was like the baked thing. You put lavender and everything. Well, we have this honey lavender and it was great. And then it seemed to kind of dip. So I was like, let's get rid of that one and do something new. But those loyal honey lavender fans, I mean, I thought we were going to get hate mail. So no, we still have it and we sell it well. People like it and people who really like it really love it. So we keep it.
And that one, and of course, you mentioned the gorgonzola one, which I have mentioned that one over the years, and that always seems to catch people's attention.
Mm-hmm. It has gorgonzola cheese and buckwheat honey, so it's this nice, robust honey. And we toast walnuts and put that on the top. It's a nice, rich truffle, dark chocolate. It's really good.
And then you have some herby ones, and you have still have the wasabi.
We switched out the ginger wasabi for that dark and stormy.
Oh, my goodness.
You have the crystallized ginger on that with the ground ginger and spiced rum, and that's really nice. And then the rosemary truffle was our first adventure into spices in chocolate. And the rosemary truffle we still have, and it's a very popular one still. So,
now how does that develop? How do you think of new truffle ideas?
Some of it, all the staff will say, hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? I often go to, when I'm thinking about different flavor profiles, I look at dressings and jams and preserves and what people are doing with meat and sauces.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Tell me why.
Mostly because if you kind of generalize out and look at kind of overall flavor profiles, chocolate can take on everything from a sweetness to a real earthiness. And so you can pull together all kinds of spices that will blend well. I mean, we have our fiery pepper with chili peppers and, you know, ancho and chipotle and smokiness and whatever. And then you have, the honey lavender, which is a white ganache with clover honey and, lavender. So this sweeter and floral. So you've got a lot of flavor profiles that play well with chocolate. And so I can kind of spread it out and really look beyond just chocolate and see what's out there and kind of bring it in and say what feels good with chocolate and what spices work well together and how does it meld together. Then, of course, we test them out. And if it's like, oh, this is gross, then it doesn't work. But a lot of times we say, ooh, this is good, but I'd like to taste a little bit more cinnamon in there or the cinnamon's overpowering it. Let's decrease that and increase something else like the ground basil. We have a cinnamon basil. So,
are there some that haven't worked?
Oh, yeah. So I always want to do a tomato basil or a tomato with a good hard parm on top, ground up on top. And so the tomato, and I feel like now I could actually pull it together and try a tomato chutney or some in a different form, like a tomato preserve or something whipped in. But at the time, I tried a dried tomato granule. And so as the moisture, it kind of rehydrated and was just chewy. It's nasty. It's gross. It was like, this not working. So we scrapped that. But, you know, it doesn't. But, like, now I'm like, oh, when I think about as I go on and as different things, you know, you see different things and different types and methods of using foods, I was like, oh, we could try to come up with a new method to reintroduce a similar sort of something. So,
is there a flavor you've always wanted to work into a truffle?
Cheese is always good. And then the tomato basil.
One of these days we're going to see that tomato basil truffle.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. Once I, you know, if I can just get all other ducks in a row and work on that one, I feel like I could really rock it out.
We've been talking with Elizabeth Garber of The Best Chocolate in Town. We'll be back with more from Elizabeth here on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio talking with Elizabeth Garber of The Best Chocolate in Town, which has been located at 880 Massachusetts Avenue since 2007. But Elizabeth, who has a degree in art and design, actually began making chocolates while still in college, selling to the same family friends who had bought her Girl Scout cookies back in the day, and then the business grew from there. Now the shop stocks about 40 varieties of truffles plus toffees, turtles, popcorn, pretzels, and other sweets. But just how did it all start?
I remember seeing some dates of 94, 95. In college, I started just as a Christmas gig, just for the holidays to make candies and sell them and make extra money. And then I officially incorporated October 1st of 1998. So, yeah, time flies when you're having fun.
So tell me a little bit about the process of that, how you decided that you were going to make chocolates and truffles and caramels, because... You know, I think you were going to be an art therapist.
Mm-hmm. I was. My degree is art and design, and art therapy was one of the avenues I was thinking about. And then I really enjoyed making the chocolate at Christmas, and I was like, well, maybe I could kind of keep selling it on the side. And I was like, well, maybe I could do this as a whole business. And when you're 22 and 23 and... everything is possible. So, and you can pull all-nighters and it doesn't hurt your body until many years later. So, so I spent, a lot of nights, days and nights just working on it and figuring out, okay, if I'm going to really do this, how do I do it? And reading up on how to create a business plan. And I did that and, really just kind of pulled it all together and realized that, the method of how I would do it, I kind of came up with, I didn't have a lot of money to start it. And so I thought, well, the name comes from, I understand now is a very arrogant name, which was pointed out to me. And I was like,
was it really? Did people say that?
I had someone who said, well, that's a really egotistical name. And I kind of went, it is. Oh God. So now I use it as kind of the, okay, this holds us to a high standard. But the goal behind the name was marketing. I had no money, and so my thought was, if I'm going to try to sell it wholesale, and I'd look in these magazines and see people advertising, I'm like, I can't do that. So if I can get it into a little shop somewhere, and then if they can use the hook that this is the best chocolate in town, and it can be a conversation starter, and it calls itself the best. So, you know, sometimes it's this self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I was thinking that if it could be on someone's shelf and says the best chocolate in town, that psychologically it already plants it as, you know, a good thing. And so it kind of was to work as its own marketing piece.
And it did, right?
It did. And it worked. I did it. So that's really where the name came from. And I had a lot of names on the list, but that I was like, okay, I can use this. And when you don't have much money to work with, you kind of figure out, how can I be creative with this? How can I make it so that, you know, make it stretch without dollars? So that's what I did.
Now, this is back in the mid-90s, and you had a website, and you jumped into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I created my own website. And those that are old enough remember register.com, which is still around, and e-commerce.com was the shopping cart. And so I created and built it. And it was actually I want to say easy now, but I'm sure back then it was. But the technology changed very quickly. But, you know, I knew how to do the links and change it up and just read how to do it and then did it. But like I said, technology moved really fast. They're like, but that's not how it, you know. So, and then I ran out of time to figure that out. And over time, I figured out cash flow a little better and figured out how to have a, you know, a put some money aside and have a marketing firm help out with other pieces and create a site and different things like that. So.
So now where were you at first? Because you weren't always here on Mass Ave.
Right. I officially opened in downtown Edinburgh, in about 300 to 400 square feet. And that encompassed all of it, the office, the cooking, you know, everything.
It's a very, very small space.
It was a small space. Yeah. But, and after a year I had to grow and I was like, oh God. And I moved north. I was in Franklin for about 8 or 9 years, in an industrial area and was still just selling wholesale and then website retail and some corporate stuff. And then in January 2007, I moved to this Mass Ave location and actually downsized to come here. So another fun mathematical adventure.
So what was it like going from wholesale to a storefront?
Yeah, it was really different. There's a difference of when your door is closed all day and you don't operate thinking about anybody else. You're just cooking in your own, like you're in your own studio. And then, you know, having a public presence all the time and established hours, and it changes how you operate with your staff, your employees, who's doing that part of it and interacting with your, with the public, and then teaching the public about product and how it's displayed. So there are a lot of obviously other moving parts and pieces. But it's really fun. It's fun to have people walk in and get excited about, you know, the cooking caramel and the smell in the air and, watching us dipping truffles and things like that on the side and through the window. And so,
because they can see all that here in the shop. And so all the magic happens right here.
Yes, it's all right here. And now it's another small space. Yeah, so it does. It all happens right here. And, so you can watch us dipping. You can see us rolling truffles and cooking caramel. And then you can pick out your own chocolates and we pack them all up right here.
So now, did you expect it to grow like it has? Because this is, you've become an established part of Mass Ave and an established part of the food scene in Indianapolis.
That's very nice to say. Thank you. I just sometimes did, and sometimes I just kept going, and then I looked back and I'm like, hey, look where I am. So yeah, so there's kind of a plan and it wiggles and moves and you shift it around and you pick a path and you try it, and sometimes there's a clearing and sometimes you have to clear the path and sometimes you backtrack. So yeah, so it was kind of the plan, but mostly it's just like cautiously move forward and you made it. You get to the end of the maze and go, look where we are.
We've been talking about the chocolate biz with Elizabeth Garber of The Best Chocolate in Town. You can check out bestchocolateintown.com for more information, and we'll be back with more with Elizabeth on the challenges of building the business here on WFYI and WFYI.org. On Eat Drink Indiana Radio today, we are talking with Elizabeth Garber of The Best Chocolate in Town, located at 880 Massachusetts Avenue in downtown Indianapolis. Now, while it might sound ideal to spend your days making chocolates for an appreciative public, as Elizabeth explains, there are plenty of challenges in the chocolate business.
It is fun, and you have to really want to do that, and it does take a lot of sacrifice. I guess, you know, you never, I tend to be, some people will come to me at times and say, hey, I want to do this. What do you think? And, you know, you never want to see anyone. I started out very young, which was a great time to just like go for it and go in debt. Then you've got the rest of your life to figure it out. So, you know, I get concerned if people are like, I'm going to put my house on this and I'm going to bet my life and my family and all my kids. I was really lucky, which can work. It can work. But I started out of college, had no kids, no family stuff. And my parents were like, well, give it a try. And so, I was really lucky that I had the support of them saying, well, give it a try. And, I'm very frugal. And so I was like, okay, I'll try it. I have a lot of patience and perseverance and flexibility. I think that's a big part of it is, well, let's figure out a solution, because there's always going to be a stumbling block. There's always going to be a wall. plan A never works. It just never works. Everybody hear that. It will not work. So plan a plan B and a C and a D and so on to infinity. So yeah. So, I mean, you're kind of always having to tweak things and relook at things and take advantage of a moment that you're like, oh, I guess we could do this, or go, oh, this is a bad idea because of X, Y, and Z, and kind of look down the road. And, you know, I spend a lot of time, my brain is kind of just always going. So I, you know, and it was difficult starting younger, at the time, female. I got, you know, people didn't call me back. I was ready to rent space and people wouldn't call me back.
Yeah, really? So, and we feel like, you know, things are pretty enlightened these mm-hmm. days, you know, but oh, say, you know, 15 years or so ago, not so much.
Yeah. Even 15 years ago. I did have, obviously some people did. And, you know, and the guys from Franklin where I landed for 8 or 9 years, they gave me a chance and they're great. And I was there for a long time. Other places, they just didn't bother to call me back. Or they'd say, well, you know, hon, it's expensive, and pat me on the head, right? So I did run into a little, not often, but just every now and then, there was just a little hint of that. I don't get so much now, luckily. There are those special few in this world that still exist.
Really? Even now?
Just here and there, but pretty rare, pretty rare. So,
so do you have what kind of other challenges did you run into?
Apparently, I look back on everything with really rose-colored glasses.
Okay, so it was great, right?
But no, it was wonderful. No, I mean, there's always challenges, and I think that you know, it's kind of some days just run more smoothly than others, and other days it's kind of just putting out fires and making sure, you know, you're bumping along the right path and getting the job done. I think I'm trying to think of any major challenges. You know, cash, of course, is always, when you're running a business, it isn't just, of course, making sure you have a good product, but then all the business part of it. And that's not always the most exciting part. And so there were some years in there. I remember year 5 and year 7 were really hard. Did a little of like, I'll pay this bill later, because that'll be okay if it's a week late, but this one won't. And this person owes me. So I spent some time doing that and the learning curve and any business of how to manage your cash flow and stuff like that.
We talked a little bit about this earlier. How do you get to the point of managing everything? Because clearly, you're not just back here making chocolate all the time.
Right. Well, and it's one of those things that you get pushed. I'm kind of in a spot where I'm running things more now, and I get to cook more, especially in the holidays. I'm like doing all of it, and I just figure coffee's the answer. But you do kind of have to get to a point where you say, would I rather have somebody operate this piece of it, or help make something else? And depending on the choice and an employee's ability, you know, you kind of move things around. I've spent more time, especially early on, establishing who we were and the brand and wanting to run things and make sure, especially because I didn't have a ton of capital, and so how to manage it. And so I've ended up doing a lot more of those things. And now I'm moving that around and outsourcing pieces and parts and saying, who can help with this piece of it and the administrative side as you grow? I still get to cook and I still have pieces and parts of that, which is the fun part. But I definitely, have a ton of production people. We make thousands and thousands and thousands of truffles and chocolates and turtles a year. And I can't do it. There are people who think I do. I'm like, I can't do it on my own.
You're not just back here, you know, or with the elves or something, you know, yeah, making all the chocolate.
So I still get to do a lot of that, but yeah, I have to have help with that. We're at a level of volume that's just lovely and ridiculous. So no, I can't do it all on my own.
Did you see it growing this much? And how many truffles do you make a year? Do you have a number? Is it a million truffles a year?
I should have that number. I don't know. Right now we have one order for Christmas that has 7,000 toffee. Yeah, and like 3,500 turtles. And it's huge.
And that's just one order.
That's just one order. But then we hundreds of thousands of truffles a year. Yeah, I should add that up just for kicks.
That's a lot of truffles.
Yeah, put it up on a wall with a ticker that changes every time we roll a truffle.
That would be kind of fun, actually.
That would be kind of fun.
So do you see it growing more?
Yeah. And in different ways. I mean, you know, if you've been in, you've seen the truffle pies. That's our latest. And so we've got some specialty pies and some things coming down the road that we're going to do that are more specialized and, you know, a little more exploration with some coffee. And we love to work with our local chefs and vendors. And right now we carry Mile Square Coffee and we work with Lick Ice Cream and Gelato Da Vinci. And so, you know, we like to work with other partners and chefs and looking to expand some special things in the next year or so.
Do you have an idea of like where you would be in 10 more years? I mean, do you want to get really big?
I think it'd be hard to get really big. I do, you know, people say, oh, open another spot, open another. But, you know, part of what makes us good is being able to manage that, control the quality. And I can see, you know, we literally are like, that truffle's too big, that truffle's too small. And when it's off site and another place and another person watching, and it can be achieved. And there are systems, people do this in business all the time. But for what we're doing and, the direction we're going to go, we definitely are going to stay small and local and grow our volume in ways that we can achieve without franchising and without going to a second location necessarily. We have a lot of wonderful retailers who carry the product. So, you know, up north in Tasteful Times and Fishers and Silver in the City and Carmel, downtown Carmel. They carry product. A lot of different places carry product, so it's not the full selection, but it's a lot of product around the area. So, yeah, just the direction we've gone has definitely not been – it's not really conducive to getting big and crazy. I'm getting too old for that.
We've been talking today with Elizabeth Garber of The Best Chocolate in Town about how she has built her business over the past 17 or so years. You can keep up with the company on Facebook and Twitter. And find it online at bestchocolateintown.com. You're listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio today here on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and we have been talking about the holidays and the chocolate business, and it just seems like the perfect time to kick off this year's Eat Drink Indy Holiday Cookie Contest. So I am looking for your best holiday cookie recipe, one that captures the flavors of the season. So last year's winner was a tangerine shortbread cookie from Indy resident Lori Goldsby, one that was both beautiful and tasty. So I would love to see your favorite holiday cookie recipe. To submit your recipe, just drop me an email at jolenekatzenberger@gmail.com. You can also find out more at eatdrinkindy.com. But for a little holiday cookie inspiration, we're going to look back at last year's contest for a little advice from some of our judges. Chef Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College, Nicole Anke Anderson of Four Birds Bakery, and A. Renee Trevino of Renee's Bakery.
Tell me what, in your opinion, makes a good holiday cookie.
Oh, a good holiday cookie has to, I don't know, the holiday tradition, right? So you've got to have something that kind of makes you think of the holidays. So some great peppermint cookies today. There's nuts, which always make me think of the holidays for some reason. But, yeah, something that makes you think about the holidays.
Any tips on cookie making?
Ooh, you know, I think the most important part is that first part where it says to add the flour, the sugar, and the butter and cream it all together. So I think a lot of people just don't do that long enough, and you don't get that really creamy consistency in the bowl before they start to add the other things. And if that doesn't happen, you're not going to get a good cookie.
And Chef Nicole Anke Anderson also judged the contest, and she has become well-known for her cookies around Indianapolis, particularly a shagbark hickory variety that has become known locally as the cookie. Until recently, she and husband Eli Anderson operated H2O Sushi in Broad Ripple. They recently closed that to focus on their personal chef business and on Nicole's Four Birds Bakery, which now provides cookies to Lucas Oil Stadium, among many other local outlets. I asked Nicole about her favorite holiday cookie, how to make it, and her cookie-making memories.
the quintessential holiday cookie for me is called a spritz cookie, and it's something that my mother has made since I can remember. And it's called a spritz. It's an almond-flavored butter cookie. But the most important part is that it's made with a cookie gun where you load the tube with the cookie dough and you put in this really fun little die that pumps the cookie out into shape.
So now you, I think you said this was your mom's cookie maker thing?
Yeah, so my mom got the cookie gun in home ec in high school, and we almost killed hers, and I found another, it's like a 1950s cookie gun on eBay, and it's the best cookie gun. I would not buy any of the fancy cookie guns at Williams-Sonoma or Sur La Table. It's got to be the old school one.
Now, why does it work so well? How does it work?
So you load the tube with the dough. You pick out your die, whether it be a Christmas tree or a poinsettia or any other. They have so many different shapes. And then you load on the gun part of it, and it kind of looks like those spackling guns. It looks like one of those. But the good thing about the old ones is that you can control the thickness of the cookies. And how much dough actually comes out of them versus the new ones. It's you're forced to have the certain size cookie, which sometimes you need the dough to be thicker, you need the cookie to be bigger, and that's what's so nice about them. And they're all metal. There's no plastic on them at all, which is how they used to do it. They were just high quality.
So it's sturdier, and it produces a better cookie, right?
100%.
So now tell me what is what makes a classic Christmas cookie for you?
I think what makes a classic holiday cookie is that, one, it has to mean something to you. I think the story behind the cookie is the most fascinating part. Who you did it with, who taught you, the memories, I think.
You bake cookies for a living, but did you grow up baking cookies?
Yes. It was waiting until the moment that I saw my mom pull out the butter to sit out overnight for these spritz cookies. It meant everything to me, and the sprinkles and the colors of the cookies and it in the Christmas tree glowing. I don't know. I just guess I have a little magical Christmas cookie memory.
Now, you have four kids, right? Four Birds Bakery, right? Do you bake a lot with the kids?
If they're interested, the fourth baby, who has actually a lot of food allergies, is the most fascinated with baking. But I don't know what kid wouldn't be willing to put sprinkles on a giant red or green shaped, you know, Christmas cookie. They do enjoy the decorating part of it. Yeah.
And did you have any favorites from today's contest?
I think I'm gonna stick with the winner, the almond cookie, tangerine cookie. I just think it was a nice, refined, thought out cookie.
And A. Renee Trevino of Renee's Bakery in Broad Ripple shared his holiday cookie memories as well.
The cookie that really stands out growing up to me was we called it a Thumbelina. It was like a sugar cookie rolled in like pecans, and you put your thumbprint in it. And then you filled it with like different jams or chocolate, and that was something I always looked forward to. That, and my brother did most of the cooking, or the baking. He did most of the cooking too for a long time. But yeah, this is a crazy time here, and it's amazing the emotion, I guess, that people get when they talk about cookies, and especially if we're out of cookies, and they don't get the cookies they want. We're like right now at the bakery, it's nonstop.
Now, are there most popular cookies every year that you can anticipate are going to be like the ones people are going to want?
Always the rollout sugar cookies. Lots of calls for gingerbread men. We do a Linzer cookie, an East Coast Linzer cookie, which is two thin butter doughs, one usually, you know, with a little hole on top and then, you know, jam in the middle. We sell tons of those for a whole month of December.
That's a lot of cookies. Do you have a favorite?
I kind of eat them all, so it really doesn't matter. I taste everything. So probably right now, the cappuccino cookie we do. That I tend to munch on those, and we'll have those till you know, right before the new year, and we'll put it away till next year.
Now, what about the cookie contest? Did you have any thoughts on the winner or any of the other cookies?
Well, just sitting down, the winner, the tangerine cookie, jumped out at me. I thought it was the most refined looking cookie. It just had a nice sheen, nice gloss, and it really surprised me with the flavor. I guess if there was any criticism, maybe the crust could have been baked just a little slightly longer. But other than that, it was an excellent cookie. And yeah, overall, I think all the cookies were really good.
We've been talking cookies with Chef Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College, pastry chef Nicole Anke Anderson of Four Birds Bakery, and pastry chef A. Renee Trevino of Renee's Bakery. For more information on the cookie contest, go to eatdrinkindy.com. So far this week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we have talked chocolates and cookies, so I figured, what the heck, let's go all out. Let's head into another local business that is crazy around the holidays, the Candy Kitchen of Carrie Abbott, owner of Newfangled Confections. I stopped in before Christmas last year to get a behind-the-scenes look at the magic of making frittle, one of Carrie's signature sweets. She also makes pralines, sweet and spicy pecans, and other treats. So as you can imagine, that Candy Kitchen is getting very busy. So we're right here where the magic happens, right? So tell me what you're doing.
I am making frittle candy. Yeah.
And what all does that entail? You have all sorts of things, and I'm standing here in the way.
Yeah, that's okay. Right now during this season, we make frittle and other candy every day, all day. And right now you are standing in the kitchen burning hot candy around you. But yeah, it is a choreographed dance. We were talking about this the other day, and we know like who is where things are hot, who's turning, and very minimal communication. I know you've been in a lot of kitchens where people give you the temperature and direction, which way they're headed. And so we do a lot of that here.
So now tell me again, for people who aren't familiar with frittle, tell me what it is and what's in it, that sort of thing.
Basic ingredients, it's sugar and a touch of corn syrup for texture for candy. And instead of finishing it with peanuts, like brittle, and a little bit of butter, we actually finish it with some peanut butter. And it is a softer version of brittle.
Now, has that become the main thing that you do? But I think you've added other things to the product line, right?
Yeah, that's right. So frittle is the original candy. We did that pretty much straight for about a year and a half when we were starting out, me and Jana over there. And then we were able to add southern pralines, as they say, for some of the Yatz restaurants. And then we still make those. Those are delicious, very sweet confection, Cajun Creole confection. And then we also added sweet and spicy pecans. As you see, I can't stop moving because candy waits on nobody.
Well, that's fine. So right now, you're cutting out the pieces of what's going to be frittle. Now tell me how long you've been at this and how it started.
Well, in the food service, I've been in for... for a few years. In candy making, this is the end of our third season. So we really still consider ourselves a brand new, young company, still learning some lots of major, what's the word I'm looking for? Learning a lot of lessons along the way, some even today. But just always love food service, always love being in the kitchen, and each job or each career, each business just somehow naturally leads into the next.
So are you very scientific about your methods?
Definitely in candy, you have to be. And it's really not a joke about the humidity thing. If it's, if we're even just washing dishes a lot, or we've got some, sweet and spicy pecans going on in the oven, and there's some moisture coming off the butter and the brown sugar mix, plus dishes, plus nonstop frittle. It just gets tacky on top, and it takes a little while to dry out.
So that actually makes a difference? I mean, even as something like washing dishes a lot in the same room can make a difference?
Yeah. I mean, and I think I've mentioned this before with you, that I really do try to break a recipe. So you get a recipe, it's good. It's really not good enough to do it a dozen times. You need it to turn out the same hundreds of times, thousands of times. So you think, like, how much of this one ingredient, how much of this heat, how much of this humidity, until it's like, I got it, I don't got it. And then you just lose, you know, the texture, or you lose being able to count on it to be the same every time. And so I'm not saying, like, you can't do one load of dishes or, you know, one load of that. It's just when it's really, really busy right now, those things do matter. And it, you know, winter even, there's a lot of humidity still, a little bit of rain or snow or ice. But summer is really a killer on us. So we don't do a ton. And it's not an emergency candy season. There's no emergency orders. So summer, we're able to, you know, work on other things, keep our wholesalers happy, maybe design some new candies. It's the end of our third year, and, you know, we're up to a whopping 4 candies. But we know all the ins and outs of those 4, and feel like we do it pretty well.
So now tell me, how much Friddle are you making in a holiday season?
I'll just say millions of pieces. Yeah.
Really?
Literally, not boxes. Yeah,
right. Literally millions of pieces.
Yeah. I've done the math, and yeah, we've done millions of pieces. So right now we're working on, it's what I would consider a large order, but a online, these subscription services, these like treat companies. Somebody ordered from us for their December subscription box about 1,200 slightly smaller amounts than Friddle Box. And if you know the Friddle Box, it has a very specific size. It was exactly 1/2 inch too tall. So they helped us together. We just developed new packaging. And I think it's going to be a winner, even at the events here in Indianapolis. And so it's a slightly less amount of Friddle, and put a really cute design sticker on it. And that's what's going to end up in these treat boxes, 1,200 of them.
That's a lot of treat boxes.
It is.
Is your December usually like this?
You know, this is, again, the third December, so it just changes. I mean, we continue to make more candy each year. We need more seasonal help each year. So I think we'll definitely continue on that path.
We've been talking with Carrie Abbott of Newfangled Confections. You can find Friddle and other treats at specialty shops and markets in Indianapolis, some supermarkets, and online at newfangledconfections.com. Recipe contests have definitely changed over the years, as home cooks have become less focused on baking from scratch. For a little insight into those changes, we talked with longtime newspaper editor Donna Kronk of the Newcastle Courier-Times.
Tell me just a little bit about the recipe contests that the newspaper has run over the years.
Okay. Well, the Courier-Times in Newcastle had 40 years of recipe contests, annual contests, and it was always a really big deal. And in the earlier days, you had homemakers that were home all the time, and they did from-scratch cooking. Plus, back 40 years ago, there weren't the convenience foods there are now. But as the years went on, and in more recent years, there were fewer and fewer of the at-home cooks. Of course, there's foodies and people who have that as a hobby. But as far as accumulating a large number of home cooks who were interested in a recipe contest, that number decreased all the time. And we still had a few really strong entrants, but the number was down. And the other trend that I noticed through the years with at-home cooks is the scratch idea of scratch cooking had changed a lot. And whereas maybe in the olden days, if you were entering a cake recipe, it would be with the eggs and the cake flour and the sifting and that sort of thing. And in more recent years, it would be, okay, you start with a cake mix and you add this and you add that. So I think it's just evolved with our culture as we have more conveniences available.
So do you think that changes the validity of a recipe, or somehow changes the idea of
of scratch cooking?
Well, I think every family and every situation is different, and you could ask probably five different people and get five different answers. What is scratch cooking? For example, I do a recipe, and I brought an example with me, but I do a recipe that's got pasta shells, and it's got canned spaghetti sauce, it's got real spinach, cheese and cottage cheese, and sausage. Well, that's probably a pretty typical, what the typical person would say, that's a scratch recipe. But if you were a real foodie, you might say, oh no, because you need to make your spaghetti sauce, you need to make your pasta. So, you know, you need to grow your wheat to make your pasta. So it's just to what extent that you take that based on your family's needs, your time, your interest in cooking, all of those things.
Now, tell me how the recipe contests at the paper evolved. Do you still even do them?
We dropped them about 3 years ago. Last year we did sort of a modified cooking contest, and we did it for our Her magazine, which is a quarterly magazine, and we had several entrants, not anything like we did when we used to have. I've been at the paper for 25 years. One year we had more than 600 entrants in the recipe contest.
Oh my goodness. Okay, now I have to tell you, that's more than I had ever gotten at the Indianapolis Star.
Well, we're probably going back 23 or 24 years when I had that many, where maybe the last year that I ran the contest, about 3 years ago, we probably had just under 100 entrants.
It's sort of interesting that food as nostalgia. People have talked about food as like a spectator sort of thing, like we watch it on TV, but we maybe don't necessarily do it, you know? So do you think that cooking is, do you think it's becoming something like that, something nostalgic or something we just look at from afar?
I definitely think there are elements of nostalgia. Maybe it's a personality thing. Maybe it's all of us think back to our youth, maybe a dish that mom made that or grandma made and wish we had the recipe for and we never thought to ask her. My mother-in-law, for example, made the most fabulous vegetable soup, beef vegetable soup. All those years, I never thought to ask her the recipe for it. I would make vegetable soup and I realized there was something missing. So she was gone and I called her sister and asked her, what did Mary make in that vegetable soup? Oh, it was cabbage. That was the secret ingredient. And that made all the difference in the world. So I think it is nostalgia, but it's also delicious.
Well, that's true. So all this home cooking, scratch cooking, it tastes really good. You know, so I think probably people want to do it. Do you think have we lost that some of those skills along the way?
I think we have because so many women work. There are men, maybe more men now cook than used to when homemakers were home all the time. But we do have very hectic lives. We're out there running around and hauling kids here and there and putting in 8 to 10 hour days at work. And so a lot of us do lean on those conveniences. And when we have time, we cook more from scratch.
Do you enjoy cooking? I mean, is it something you have done a lot of over the years? You have favorite recipes?
I like to cook. I can't say I love to cook. I think I like reading. A lot of women have told me this, that they like reading cookbooks, like a novel. And I enjoy that. And I always think, oh, I'm going to try this and I'm going to try that. Last week, for example, I decided to sit down and make a from scratch cake. And it had been ages since I had done that. So I like to cook. Maybe in the years to come, I'll do more of it. But I think I like reading about it, maybe more.
Now, how have you seen the recipes change over the years?
They are leaning towards that semi-homemade aspect. They take elements of what you would consider maybe from scratch cooking, gathering ingredients, but also taking pre-made things like maybe the pasta sauce or I don't know, a mix and modifying it in some way. And I think all of the social media has a big influence on that as well. With the Pinterest, all the cool recipes on Pinterest and just the neat twists you can do with recipes. So I think a lot of us have become more semi-homemade than exclusively homemade.
We've been talking recipe contests with newspaper editor Donna Kronk of the Newcastle Courier-Times. Stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 and WFYI.org. So it's interesting for me to hear about how recipe contests have changed over the years and how the whole approach to home cooking has maybe changed as well. As someone who loves to cook, I find myself wondering if my cooking style fits into that changing definition of what homemade means. I cook at home almost every day, but I'm not always cooking up a whole meal. Sometimes it's just an over-easy egg for breakfast, and sometimes, yes, it's pizza sauce spread on a packaged crust and topped with pepperoni and cheese. But then again, sometimes it's a roast chicken, one of the most successful dishes that I made this past week, because it eventually turned into chicken salad and then homemade stock and then eventually chicken and dumplings. But I have to tell you, that roast chicken was served with box stuffing because one of the kids really likes it. But I don't know if my cooking style has changed very much. I think it just depends on the situation. I'll make biscuits from scratch sometimes, and other times I'll pop them out of a can. Or sometimes I'll make my spaghetti sauce, and other times I'll use the jarred variety. I think that what matters most is being in the kitchen and cooking with and for the ones you love. I'll be sure to remember that come Thanksgiving Day, and I won't feel guilty about that box stuffing the kids like. I'll just give thanks that we're cooking and eating together. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. It was a tasty show today, and we kicked off the EatDrinkIndy.com and WFYI Holiday Cookie Contest. And I want to encourage all of you to submit a recipe for the contest. Just send it in an email to JoleneKetzenberger@gmail.com. And, of course, I want to thank our guests this week, Elizabeth Garber of The Best Chocolate in Town, Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College, Nicole Ann Key Anderson of Four Birds Bakery, A. Renee Trevino of Renee's Bakery, Carrie Abbott of Newfangled Confections, and Donna Kronk of the Newcastle Courier-Times. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.